Welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson, and today we are taking on, well, a really ambitious mission. It's a forensic granular investigation into just 48 hours of some pretty dizzying federal activity. The title for this deep dive is The Federal News Update for Thursday, December 11th, 2025.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. And, you know, this isn't just a simple news roundup. What we're doing here is an exhaustive review of every significant U.S. federal government action and its implications since the start of December 10th.
So a hyper-condensed 48-hour window.
Exactly. And it's packed with legislative, executive, and even kinetic military action that has fundamentally reshaped policy, not just here at home, but across the globe. The goal for you listening is to really understand the current administration's governing strategy.
Right, how they're turning campaign talk into actual law.
That's it. Specifically, yeah. How they are using that unilateral executive power while at the same time working to cement the rhetoric into irreversible statutory law.
And that strategy, that sort of aggressive enforcement and strategic escalation, was on full display right out of the gate, especially when we look overseas. I think we have to start with the highest profile kinetic military action of this period. The dramatic seizure of an enormous oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela.
This was confirmed by President Trump himself on December 11th. And the details are, they're striking, just because of the sheer scale and complexity of the operation.
The president called it the largest tanker ever seized.
Yeah, in recent memory, potentially holding millions of barrels of crude.
And the images, the operational descriptions that came out later, they really revealed how high stakes this whole thing was. I mean, we're talking about a highly skilled, fast rope insertion onto a moving vessel by American forces.
And the coordination behind that is just remarkable. It's not just one agency.
Yeah.
You've got the Department of War supplying the core military component, but they're assisted by Homeland Security. The Coast Guard is in there for maritime awareness and logistics.
And even the FBI, which suggests a focus on sanctions or maybe even counterterrorism.
Right. It takes an immense amount of planning and, frankly, a whole lot of bravery to pull off an operation like that on the open water.
So what's the bigger picture here? What are the geopolitical implications of seizing a tanker like this?
Well, they're massive. This moves way beyond a typical interdiction. U.S. officials believe this specific vessel was transporting sanctioned Venezuelan oil, and the intended destination was Cuba.
And why Cuba?
Because the thinking in Washington has long been that Cuba acts as a kind of clearinghouse. They take the sanctioned oil, sell it on the black market, and that generates the hard currency the Maduro regime in Venezuela needs to stay afloat.
So this isn't just stopping some smugglers. This is a direct, calculated attack on Maduro's lifeline.
Precisely. It's his financing structure. It keeps the lights on, keeps the military loyal. This action is viewed by pretty much all foreign policy analysts as a major intentional escalation.
An escalation from what, though?
Well, until now, the U.S. strategy was often described as coercive diplomacy. You know, threats, sanctions, freezing assets to try and change Maduro's behavior. This seizure, though, moves the strategy squarely into what you can only call a maximum pressure campaign.
Echoing tactics used against Iran.
Exactly. The clear, unstated goal here is regime change. Starve the regime of resources. It moves beyond just counter-narcotics, even though that's still part of the narrative.
But whenever you have this kind of kinetic action, the legal questions are right behind. The president was asked about the oil, 2 million barrels of crude, and his response was, pretty ambiguous. He said, and I'm quoting here, we keep it, I guess, and then just told reporters to follow the tanker.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the actual legal hurdles here? What do you do with a seized vessel and its cargo?
Well, that ambiguity is strategic, but it also reflects genuine legal complexity. Under international maritime law and U.S. forfeiture statutes, it's complicated. Once a sanctioned vessel is taken, it's in the U.S. government's possession. But the legal process is slow.
So they don't just immediately own the oil.
No, not at all. They have to prove in a U.S. court that the vessel and cargo were used in violation of sanctions. It would likely be a civil forfeiture action where the property itself is the defendant.
And if they win that case?
If the forfeiture is successful and the U.S. has a very high success rate in these cases, then the government has to decide what to do. Do they sell the oil and put the money in the treasury? Or just hold it in port as evidence, which is incredibly expensive.
And the crew.
The crew, assuming they're not U.S. citizens or involved in terrorism, will likely be released through diplomatic channels. But even that's always fraught with political risk. What this whole action really signifies is the administration's aggressive enforcement of its national security doctrine in the Western Hemisphere.
And yet this escalating military posture is creating a lot of friction with Congress. We saw reports that Defense Secretary Hegseth, the Joint Chiefs Chair General Kane, and Secretary of State Rubio all had to brief senior senators, it's Gang of Eight, on this mission. And the consensus was apparently negative.
That's a crucial internal tension. Yeah. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer came out very publicly and demanded greater transparency. He said the briefing was, quote, deeply unsatisfying.
And he brought up a previous controversial operation, didn't he?
He did. He stressed they still hadn't provided the necessary details on that double tap strike from early September, the one that reportedly killed two survivors clinging to wreckage. Schumer is demanding that Hegseth allow every single member of Congress to view the unedited video footage of that prior incident.
Wait, hold on. They're demanding video of a previous strike while being briefed on a new one.
Hmm.
That suggests the profound breakdown of trust between the executive and legislative branches on the use of force.
It absolutely does. And Senator Mark Warner also stressed the need for concrete written documents about that previous strike. He wants the JAGI opinion, the legal assessment, the after-action report, the execution order, all of it.
To prove the actions were legal.
To prove they were appropriate under both domestic and international law. So while the executive branch is acting unilaterally and aggressively now, Congress is aggressively demanding accountability for what happened before. It's a real tension between executive speed and legislative oversight.
Okay, let's move from kinetic foreign policy to domestic security. The Department of Justice, under Attorney General Pam Bondi, is also pushing the administration's security posture, but with huge implications for civil liberties. It looks like a pretty sophisticated dual-track strategy to redefine domestic law enforcement.
That's the right way to put it. On one track, the DOJ is reportedly drafting a formal official list of individuals and maybe even organizations designated as domestic terrorists. This is a significant move. It could expand surveillance powers, restrict constitutional rights for anyone on that list.
And reports mentioned First Amendment footnotes in the drafting process. A footnote doesn't sound like a very strong legal constraint. Is this just legal window dressing, or is there real internal friction over this?
It definitely signals friction, but it's also a procedural necessity. The footnotes are an acknowledgement that, unlike with foreign terrorist groups, domestic designations have to comply with the U.S. Constitution. You know, rights to free speech, assembly, due process. It creates this legal tightrope for the DOJ.
So the question is, where's the line?
Where is the line? Exactly. Can simply advocating for a cause, no matter how extreme, land you on the list? Or do they need evidence of intent and capability to commit violence? The internal debates are clearly over how far they can stretch that definition.
And on the second track, the regulatory one, we saw a very clear rollback of civil rights enforcement published on December 10th.
This is pure executive unilateralism at work. The Federal Register published new rules that rescind parts of the DOJ's Title VI regulations.
And Title VI is what exactly?
Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. It prohibits discrimination based on race, color, or national origin in any program or activity that gets federal money. So police departments, school districts, housing authorities, if they get federal funds, they have to comply. These rules being rescinded are how the DOJ ensures that happens.
And what's the administration specifically targeting by getting rid of them?
The action is explicitly aimed at implementing Executive Order 14281, which was designed to dismantle key parts of the previous administration's civil rights infrastructure. It specifically limits the use of disparate impact analysis. That's where a policy is found discriminatory, even if you can't prove intent, just because its effect disproportionately harms a protected group.
So they're making it harder to prove discrimination.
They're contracting the federal government's role in civil rights oversight and shifting the burden of proof onto the people alleging discrimination.
Absolutely. This theme of institutionalizing these priorities, moving from just executive action to permanent law, is nowhere clearer than in the big legislative action of the week. The passage of the FY 2026 National Defense Authorization Act. The NDAA.
Absolutely. The House passed it on December 10th by a pretty commanding vote, 312-112. And you have to understand, this is so much more than a military budget, this $900.6 billion authorization. It's a comprehensive multi-year policy overhaul designed to lock in this administration's defense vision.
And the most significant part of this bill, as you said, is its use for statutory entrenchment. And we can't overstate this. The NDAA codifies 15 separate presidential executive orders, turning these temporary policies into permanent federal law.
That is the core powerful takeaway. An EO, as you know, is the easiest thing for a new president to rescind. You just sign a new one. Statutory laws, however, require a whole new act of Congress to overturn. You need the House, the Senate, and the president's signature, or a veto override. By codifying these 15 orders, they're ensuring this defense philosophy will persist for, well, for decades, potentially.
Okay, let's unpack some of what's in there, because it redefines the military's direction, both culturally and technologically at the same time. Let's start with the cultural shift.
This is where the cultural warfare element really gets cemented into law. The NDAA specifically codifies Executive Order 14151. This EO is all about ending what the administration calls radical and wasteful government DEI.
Diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Right. The bill explicitly eliminates statutory provisions related to DEI programs in the DOD. It dismantles the DEI offices, and it prohibits DEI training. The stated goal is purging woke ideology from the military, which they argue hurts unit cohesion and readiness.
And the pushback, of course, is that this will harm recruitment and retention, especially among minority service members.
Exactly. Critics argue these programs were essential for addressing retention issues for women and minorities, but the administration sees that as a secondary concern. And then beyond the culture, the bill drastically accelerates technology modernization.
Tell us about that.
It codifies another EO, 14307, which is focused on unleashing American drone dominance. So it prioritizes autonomous systems, removes regulatory hurdles, mandates huge procurement increases for unmanned platforms. It also fully funds some very expensive signature priorities, most notably the Golden Dome Missile Defense Initiative.
Which is supposed to be like Israel's Iron Dome, but for the entire U.S.
Scaled for continental defense, yeah. Against advanced ICBMs and hypersonic threats. The funding here is in the tens of billions. It's a monumental shift in spending toward homeland defense.
But even with all this support for the administration's goals, the bill also had some pretty strict congressional constraints built in. It seems like there's still a lot of anxiety about the president's America First tendencies.
That's a crucial internal tension that really defined the final negotiations. Despite agreeing on things like DEI and drones, the NDAA includes very strict, specific prohibitions on troop reductions in key theaters.
Specifically Europe and South Korea.
Right. This is Congress using its power of the purse to mandate specific force levels. It ensures that even if the president wanted a rapid unilateral drawdown from NATO or the Korean Peninsula, the Department of War would be statutorily blocked from doing it without congressional approval.
And before we get to what was lost in the bill, let's talk about what was in it for the workforce.
Yes. There's a 3.8% pay raise for all service members, which is above the current inflation rate. Plus, significant funding for military housing and childcare subsidies. These are critical issues for the recruitment crisis. But even here, there was drama. Speaker Mike Johnson stripped a bipartisan provision that would have expanded TRICARE coverage for IVF, citing pro-life protections. That drew immediate condemnation from Democrats.
Okay, so this is where the story gets really interesting, especially for taxpayers and military efficiency.
Yeah.
The key, widely supported acquisition reforms that were systematically stripped from the final bill. This sounds like a major win for the defense lobby.
It's a devastating defeat for accountability and readiness, the widely popular right to repair provisions.
Which would let service members fix their own equipment.
Exactly. The ability to access manuals, tools, the data needed to fix their own gear in the field, all of that was completely removed after intense pushback from defense lobbyists.
And to give our listener a concrete example, what does not having right to repair mean for a soldier?
It means unnecessary delays. Critical equipment just sitting there. Imagine a high-tech vehicle breaks down at a forward operating base, a minor software fault. But because the contractor controls the proprietary diagnostic software, that unit can't fix it. They have to wait, sometimes weeks, for a contractor to fly out and charge exorbitant fees just to run a diagnostic tool. It undermines readiness and costs a fortune.
And there were two very specific, comprehensive measures that got dropped.
Precisely. The House had a data as a service solutions measure that would have required the DOD to get full access to technical data and software before signing a contract. The Senate had a parallel provision requiring contractors to provide detailed repair instructions and parts lists. Both were systematically thrown out.
So why the fierce resistance? The industry says it hampers innovation, but it has to be about money.
It is entirely financial. Lobbyists from groups like the NDIA and Aerospace Industries Association argued that sharing proprietary data would cripple innovation. But the reality is, their business model relies on maintaining control over maintenance and repair data. That's how they capture those massive, high-margin, recurring service contracts for decades.
And the compromise they reached was basically nothing.
A token measure. Instead of enforcement, the law now just requires the DoD to develop a digital system to track the data it currently has and review existing contracts. It's an administrative study, not an enforceable right. As one expert put it, industry prevailed, and the NDAA now reflects the interests of the business community instead of the American taxpayers and service members.
And it wasn't just Right to Repair that vanished. A December 10th report detailed a whole raft of other transparency and acquisition reforms that were dropped. Let's start with pricing transparency.
This is critical. Both the House and Senate had strong provisions to close a loophole that lets companies submit cost and pricing data after the contract price is already agreed on. Those measures, designed to give contracting officers the info they need to get a fair deal, were entirely removed.
So contractors can still use old or incomplete data, and the DoD has to play catch-up. What about oversight on huge programs with massive cost overruns?
The House had tried to rein those in. They proposed accelerating the Pentagon's reporting timeline. Right now, the DoD has a lot of time to notify Congress after a program hits a critical cost overrun. The proposal was to require an alert to Congress within 30 days. That was also blocked, so Congress stays in the dark longer about massive fiscal problems.
We also saw reforms to something called other transaction authorities, or OTAs, get dropped. What are those, and why did Congress want to reform them?
OTAs are streamlined contracting vehicles. They're meant to bypass the usual lengthy regulations to acquire innovative tech quickly. But there's very little transparency about whether they actually lead to effective follow-on contracts. A House proposal to track those success metrics didn't make it in.
So instead of accountability, we got a study.
Exactly. The final bill just directs the GAO to conduct a general review. Softer. And a proposal to subject large OTA-funded projects to the same oversight as major defense programs was also dropped.
And even efforts to help veteran-owned small businesses were stripped away.
Yes, proposals that would have required the DoD to set annual contracting goals specifically for VOSBs were removed. Without those goals, it's very hard for them to compete. Also stripped was a proposal to create a standardized way to report veteran employment data on DoD contracts, another loss for accountability.
So it sounds like the process achieved two opposite goals. It made core cultural policy permanent while ensuring the defense industry stays insulated from accountability and transparency.
That's the perfect summary. The administration got its ideological wins through entrenchment, but the traditional contractor establishment ensured they wouldn't be constrained by reforms that would benefit the taxpayer.
Okay, this takes us right to the economic and fiscal policy battlefronts. Inflation, cost of living, these are driving huge government decisions. We have to start with the Federal Reserve's big decision on December 10th.
The FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee, cut interest rates by a quarter point, 0.25%. That lowers the key rate to a range of 3.5 to 3.75%. It was the first cut in nearly a year.
But the vote was unusually fractured. That suggests some major internal disagreements.
It was a narrow 9-3 vote, but the discord is even clearer when you look at the dot plot projections. 7 of the 19 participants didn't agree with the decision to cut now. 6 members wanted no rate cut at all, and 1 member actually wanted a much larger 50 basis point cut immediately. It shows how difficult it is for Chair Powell to maintain any kind of unity right now.
What exactly is the Fed trying to balance here that's causing this split?
They're balancing 2 very serious competing risks. On one hand, if you cut rates now, you risk inflation flaring up again, especially after the new tariffs raise the cost of imported goods. On the other hand, if you hold rates high, you risk a weak labor market. Job creation is pretty flat right now. The debate really centers on the high price level versus the rate of inflation.
The frustration over high grocery bills and Christmas shopping costs.
Exactly. And the members who voted to cut believe the best way to protect people from those high prices is to protect the labor market, to ensure wage growth can keep up.
Which brings us to the White House's side of this. The president has continued his longstanding criticism of Chairman Powell.
It's been relentless. Accusing Powell of killing the growth, he publicly slammed him for not moving fast enough on cuts. Most improbably, he's floated this idea that U.S. GDP growth could be 20 to 25%.
20 to 25%. What's the economic theory there? How would you get that growth without massive inflation?
Well, their argument relies on this idea of untapped domestic production capacity. They argue that deregulation and new trade deals can unleash American manufacturing and energy, so the supply side of the economy just explodes. But, you know, most mainstream economists would counter that a 25% growth rate would instantly create enormous demand for labor, spike wages, and lead to, as the president himself calls it, enormous inflation. It's a political counter-narrative.
And at the same time, the executive branch is using a new regulatory weapon to fight prices, specifically by targeting the food supply chain under a national security pretext.
This is a major fundamental policy shift. It's encapsulated in Executive Order 14364, published on December 10th. The title is Addressing Security Risks from Price Fixing and Anti-Competitive Behavior in the Food Supply Chain. It formally declares high food prices a national security threat.
That's a huge change for U.S. antitrust policy. For decades, it's been guided by the consumer welfare model.
It is historic. The consumer welfare standard means enforcement only happens if you can prove practices harm the consumer through higher prices or less choice. This EO shifts enforcement to a nationalist security-focused model. By calling it a national security threat, the administration can empower the DOJ and USDA to threaten criminal proceedings against big agribusiness conglomerates using a much lower legal threshold.
And the timing of the investigation is strategically political.
Oh, absolutely. The EO mandates reports and investigations on a timeline that's set to deliver findings and maybe criminal complaints right as the 2026 midterm elections are kicking off. It allows them to scapegoat corporations for high prices, deflecting anger away from federal policies.
Speaking of political warfare, the Treasury Department is also getting in on this, using tax policy to pit the federal government against blue states.
Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent issued this very charged press release on December 10th titled, Liberal States Blocking Historic Tax Cuts for Hardworking Americans and Workers.
And what's the specific accusation?
He accused officials in Colorado, New York, Illinois, and D.C. of political obstruction. The issue is that they won't conform their state tax codes to two popular federal changes, the no tax on tips and no tax on overtime provisions.
So how did that work?
Well, many states use the federal adjusted gross income, the AGI, as their starting point for calculating state taxes. When the federal government exempts tips and overtime from that AGI, the state tax base automatically shrinks too, giving a state tax cut. So these states have to actively pass laws to decouple from the federal definition to avoid that tax cut.
And by not doing that, Treasury is accusing them of robbing their residents.
Exactly. It paints liberal state governments as the enemies of the working class. So if people in those states don't see the full relief promised by the White House, the federal government can immediately point the finger at blue state officials, not at their own policies like tariffs. It's weaponizing fiscal federalism.
Okay, we have to pivot now to the huge changes affecting the federal workforce, regulatory agencies, and social programs. Let's start with the IRS and the return to office mandate. The crackdown on telework seems to be raising some serious concerns.
It's a profound shift. A memo from the IRS reported December 9th confirmed that the agency closed all pending hardship-based requests for full-time telework, effective immediately. And they did this without even reviewing the merits of the thousands of cases that had already been submitted.
What are the new restrictions and what were these hardship requests usually for? I mean, what's the human impact?
Well, employees are now generally limited to just 5 days of telework per calendar year. That's a huge decrease. Previously, the IRS would grant long-term hardship telework for severe personal emergencies. We heard about cases involving employees facing domestic violence who needed an undisclosed work location for their safety, or people who are immunocompromised after an organ transplant.
And those cases have just been dumped back into the regular queue, which is already swamped.
Correct. And now, any new requests for reasonable accommodation have to be approved by top agency leadership. It's a severe bottleneck. That office is already dealing with a backlog of over 8,000 requests, and they're inundated with paperwork from all the employees retiring.
So an employee needing urgent accommodation could now wait months for approval.
That is the fear. It could force vulnerable employees to take extended unpaid leave. And because the IRS no longer recognizes the main employee union, they've lost their ability to use the union's expedited grievance procedure. They're left with a much slower, more costly, formal complaint process.
And we're seeing similar moves at the Department of Health and Human Services.
Yes. HHS rolled out a new policy that requires all telework or remote work requests, even for disability, to be approved by an assistant secretary or higher. It's part of a concerted government-wide effort to force a physical return to federal offices.
All right, let's talk about the monumental changes happening in U.S. health policy under Secretary RFK Jr. and his MAHA, Make America Healthy Again agenda. This seems like a rapid dismantling of decades of established medical practice.
The speed and the scope of the disruption is startling public health experts. Last week, the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, the ACIP, which has been handpicked by Kennedy, voted to roll back a foundational decades-old recommendation.
Which one?
That all newborns receive a birth dose of the hepatitis B vaccine.
Wow. Why is that birth dose so fundamental?
It's foundational because hepatitis B is a silent infection. Babies can get it from an infected mother and show no symptoms, but it can lead to chronic liver failure or cancer later in life. The birth dose was critical because the mother's status is often unknown. Rolling that back is a deep rejection of population-level preventative medicine. Public health officials say it will inevitably lead to outbreaks.
And the White House signaled this was just the beginning.
Absolutely. The same day as the ACIP vote, the White House ordered health officials to fast-track a review of the entire pediatric vaccine schedule to align it with other countries. This gives Kennedy a clear mandate to challenge all standard immunization practices.
And the FDA launched investigations that amplify this.
On December 10th and 11th, reports confirm the FDA is expanding its investigation into possible deaths in adults linked to the COVID-19 vaccine. They also launched a safety review of newly approved monoclonal antibodies for RSV, which are critical for protecting infants.
So what's the reaction from both sides here?
Well, critics view this MAHA agenda as a profound threat to the integrity of public health institutions. They worry it will erode public confidence in the whole medical system. Supporters, however, believe they are just getting started. One ally said they plan to challenge other standard practices like mammograms and colonoscopies, arguing they might cause the very diseases they seek to detect. The goal is a wholesale disruption.
This upheaval is mirrored by a quieter institutional dismantling of the federal statistical agencies, the ones that provide the bedrock data for our economy. This sounds less dramatic, but the long-term impact could be devastating.
It's an immediate capacity crisis. As of December 10th, most federal statistical agencies have lost between 20 and 30% of their highly specialized staff this year, and the administration is pursuing further cuts.
20 to 30%. That's crippling for any agency, let alone one that requires specialized expertise.
It is. The most extreme example is the National Center for Education Statistics, which lost nearly all its employees. It has 3 people left. The agency is effectively paralyzed.
And what are the concrete consequences? What data are we losing?
We're seeing the delay, suspension, or cancellation of public-facing data sets. The Census Bureau terminated 5 surveys. We're losing granular data that financial markets rely on, detailed price index reports, specialized labor reports, agricultural projections. One former director stressed these agencies produce the bedrock statistics that the financial world looks to.
So high-quality data is disappearing, which affects everything from economic assessment to AI development.
Precisely. AI models, especially in finance, require massive amounts of high-fidelity data that these agencies collect. When that data disappears or gets worse, it hampers innovation and weakens the government's ability to even understand its own economy. And on top of that, public trust in federal statistics has fallen, creating a feedback loop of decaying data quality.
Okay, to round out the domestic activity, we need to focus on the coordinated, multi-front attack on the 8A Small Business Contracting Program. This program is meant to help firms owned by disadvantaged individuals compete for federal contracts.
And it is facing unprecedented pressure from the executive branch, Congress, and the courts all at the same time. It suggests a unified ideological push.
Let's start with the executive branch's role through the Small Business Administration, the SBA.
The SBA has launched an incredibly invasive audit. They sent letters to over 4,300 firms demanding 13 different data sets due by January 5th. This data haul is massive. 3 years of general ledgers, bank statements, payroll registers, lists of all employees by contract. It's a huge burden for a small business.
It sounds designed to overwhelm them and force them out through noncompliance. How is Congress backing this up?
Senator Joni Ernst, who chairs the Small Business Committee. On December 10th, she wrote to 22 agencies, calling on them to immediately halt all new 8A sole source contract awards until the audit is complete. She views the program with deep skepticism.
And the third front is a legal challenge that attacks the very structure of the program.
Correct. A new lawsuit was filed in Louisiana. And this one is more fundamental. It targets the core SBA rule that presumes certain individuals are socially disadvantaged based on race or ethnicity. The goal is to strike down that rule itself, which would force the SBA to do individualized assessments for every applicant, a process that's basically impossible and would dismantle the program. Some former officials view this as the administration targeting the program because they see it as just another DEI handout.
It's a remarkable convergence of auditing, oversight, and judicial challenge, all focused on one program. Okay, let's shift back to Capitol Hill and the immediate legislative calendar. Specifically, the Senate healthcare showdown scheduled for December 11th.
This is high-stakes political theater. It's about the Affordable Care Act premium tax credit cliff. These are set to expire December 31st. If Congress does nothing, the federal subsidies disappear, and premiums for about 21.8 million Americans will double overnight.
And Senate Majority Leader John Thune sigiled two competing votes, which everyone immediately saw as a maneuver designed to fail.
It's the political genius or cynicism of it. They scheduled a vote on the Democratic proposal for a clean extension of the subsidies and a vote on the Republican counterproposal to replace them with health savings accounts. Neither bill can get the 60 votes needed to pass. So Republicans can claim they offered an alternative while letting the subsidies expire.
And how does that benefit them? Doesn't letting the subsidies expire hurt them politically?
It benefits them by starving the ACA of funds without ever taking a direct, politically difficult vote to repeal it. They can tell their base they didn't fund it, and they can tell voters they offered a better alternative. Meanwhile, Democrats can run campaign ads in 2026 focused entirely on the premium hikes, blaming the GOP. It's a classic legislative strategy.
Moving from healthcare gridlock to ethics, the stock trading ban debate gained some traction, but it also highlighted some internal divisions.
Representative Ana Paulina Luna introduced a discharge petition to try and force a vote on a bipartisan bill to bar lawmakers and their families from trading individual stocks. This has wide public support, but it runs into massive resistance from congressional leadership.
And the debate immediately pivoted to presidential corruption.
Exactly. Democrats criticized the ban because it doesn't apply to the executive branch. Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries called it an active ongoing crime scene coming out of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. They point to President Trump's substantial ownership stakes in publicly traded companies like Trump Media and Broadcom. They argue that without extending the ban, it's incomplete.
And there's a similar rush to finalize crypto market regulation before the holiday recess.
Senators are really running out of time on a crucial market structure bill, and the sticking points are serious, mostly related to governance and ethics. Democrats are pushing hard for quorum language and robust ethics language.
What does that quorum language refer to?
It's about ensuring stability at the SEC and the CFTC, the bodies that would oversee crypto. They want a provision that would legally require a minimum number of commissioners from both parties to be present for any major regulatory action. This is critical because the SEC's last remaining Democrat is set to leave next month, and the CFTC is down to just a single acting chair. Without a quorum, these bodies could be paralyzed.
And the ethics language is also driven by concerns about conflicts of interest.
It is. Democrats want to restrict elected officials and their families from issuing or profiting from digital assets while in office, given the Trump family's increasing footprint in the crypto industry. If they don't finalize this bill now, the market could be left in regulatory uncertainty heading into an election year.
Finally, let's look at federal tech and IT modernization. We saw a big last-minute award from the Technology Modernization Fund, or TMF, just before its authorization expires.
That's right. In a rush to spend down its funds, the TMF board made a crucial investment of $28.3 million to the National Nuclear Security Administration, the NNSA. And it's highly focused on modernizing the tech that supports their nuclear stockpile and emergency response missions.
And how is the NNSA planning to use that money?
The majority, about $23 million, is for accelerating AI infrastructure modernization inside their classified cloud environment. The goal is to implement their own secure, air-gapped version of a commercial cloud platform, but with built-in pre-approved AI tools. This will help analysts leverage AI for things like computational physics modeling without compromising security.
And the rest goes to specific emergency response projects.
Yes, two targeted applications, $3 million for Turbo FRMAC, which is shifting a radiological assessment tool to the cloud. This gives emergency response teams more speed and collaboration in a nuclear crisis. The other $2 million goes to FireGuard, which uses machine learning to automatically track fire boundaries in real time, which is critical for protecting nuclear sites from wildfires.
And this AI focus is echoed at the DoD on a huge scale.
Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth announced the rollout of Jenny iMIL. It's the first major deployment of a commercial generative AI platform, Google Gemini, across the entire Pentagon for unclassified work.
And what kind of work will it handle?
This is about administrative efficiency, streamlining personnel onboarding, automating documentation, accelerating contract workflows, synthesizing open source research. Hegseth framed it as putting the world's most powerful AI models directly into the hands of every American warrior. It's a clear sign that AI adoption is now a systemic mandate.
While all this was going on, the Senate continued its work reshaping the federal judiciary.
Yes, they confirmed two lifetime appointments to district court seats, James D. Maxwell II in Mississippi and William J. Crane in Louisiana. These confirmations ensure the administration's legal philosophy will persist in the federal courts for decades. So as we synthesize everything from this jam-packed 48-hour period, two central powerful themes really emerge. It illustrates the administration's whole governing strategy, statutory entrenchment, and aggressive executive unilateralism.
The entrenchment is so clear in the NDAA. I mean, using a must-pass bill to codify 15 executive orders, making things like the elimination of DEI programs or the pivot to drone dominance into permanent federal law.
And the unilateralism shows up when Congress is slow or hostile. The seizure of the Venezuelan tanker framed around national security and that new food security EO, which also uses a national security pretext to launch antitrust investigations. Both show willingness to leverage these high-level security authorities to bypass conventional constraints and just get things done quickly.
The underlying tension we saw across all of this, though, is this headlong clash between these aggressive strategies and the tangible economic reality for voters' inflation and high prices. That tension drove the messaging from Treasury, the divided vote at the Fed, the food security EO. I mean, the administration is trying to rewrite the rules of government itself.
It is. It's rewriting the rules on who gets federal contracts with the eight challenges, what data is trustworthy through the attack on statistical agencies, and even what's permissible in foreign policy with the Venezuelan seizure. So when you consider the elimination of DEI across the DOD, the political battle over DEI in the SBA, and these massive staffing cuts crippling the statistical agencies, you have to ask, what happens to the long-term capacity and institutional memory of the federal apparatus when core tenets of accountability, objective measures, and fair competition are all removed or severely degraded at the same time? That erosion of capacity is a critical question for the future functioning of the entire U.S. government.
That is profound food for thought. Thank you for diving into all of this with us.
Always a pleasure. We'll catch you next time for the next deep dive.